Tom Gimbel is here, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, to talk a little bit about this robust jobs report, which, and I'll ask you the same question I ask everybody when I get what appears to be good news, Tom. Is this good news, or is this good news, bad news?
Good news, John Williams. There's no doubt about it that when you have an economy that's been going gangbusters for this long and still adding over 300,000 jobs, that is a wonderful signal for the economy and the citizens within that economy.
But what does that do to inflation, or what does that signal for interest rates down the road?
Well, I think what you see is that inflation is not the topic that it was 6 months ago. I think we've seen that the story of the $7 eggs is not being talked about as much. And while it's not perfect, it's a lot better.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that interest rates are at a level that is allowing the economy to still flourish and jobs to still be created. So the Fed is actually doing a really good balancing act. And I think the thought is that they probably won't do a rate increase at the next meeting, but they will in two meetings as the economy continues to thrive. And then they'll raise it up probably another 25 basis points.
To what do you attribute these good jobs numbers?
Well, I think first and foremost, there's simply more companies now than there ever have been in the history of the world, to be quite frank, is that, you know, 25 years ago when the air quotes internet was created and we had e-commerce and all these other things, we've got more startups. We've got these technology huge companies that really were the ones that did the layoffs, but they're still hiring in different areas. And the biggest change, John, is that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, if somebody got laid off in the accounting department at General Motors, they really only had a choice to go get a job at Chrysler or at Ford. Now you get laid off in the oil business or automobiles or technology, and the economy sees your skills as transferable. And so there's much bigger demand for people than ever before. And so it's just a healthier economy when it comes to the jobs.
Do you think we're also still in the moment of people left their jobs during the pandemic, they don't come back, so we just need more employees, that hiring is robust because of the vacuum they created?
No, I don't necessarily think that's the case anymore. I think what we saw when unemployment ticks up 0.3% like it did, yet we're adding over 300,000 jobs, I think that those people coming into the workforce were a lot of those big workers who took time off and they re-entered, or they were doing a hodgepodge of different independent contractor jobs and they're coming back. So I think that little blip of people who were quitting to do nothing or to do gig work or whatever is silently coming to a close, and we're getting back to a more traditional based economy.
One last thing. What are you seeing in your business? What kind of jobs are coming through LaSalle Network?
It's really in all areas. We actually saw a 15% uptick in jobs over the past couple weeks of orders coming in. We're seeing it in IT. We're seeing it in accounting and finance. Sales hiring, which is a great sign for the economy, continues to be great. Mm. And we're also seeing a full rebound on the healthcare side. We have a healthcare revenue cycle practice that does back office for healthcare, and which means more elective procedures, more non-critical stuff, which means the pandemic's really in the rearview mirror, which is a great sign.
Tom Gimbel, founder, CEO, LaSalle Network. Okay, Tom, let's talk again. Thank you, sir.
Stay healthy, be well, go Cubs. Talk to you later, Jeff.
One quick note about what Tom said. He thinks that inflation is in the rearview mirror. You don't hear about $7 eggs. Gas is down, and all of that is true. I think that Tom is right about that. And yet in a News Nation poll on the 24 race conducted just about a week ago, thousands of Americans were asked, what do you think is a bigger problem facing the United States today? Inflation, unemployment, crime, or immigration? Immigration was number three of the four on the list. Inflation was number one. 55% of us still say that inflation is the biggest problem in America. Crime, 18%. Inflation, 55%. Here's Philip Weiss talking not about the interview that got you the job or the exit interview, but it sounds like something in between. Philip is the president of SciFarth at Work. Hey, Philip, how have you been?
Great. How have you been, John?
I'm good. What's this in-between interview?
Yeah, in-between is the right way to title this phenomenon and this manager activity, because we all know the candidate interview. We all know the exit interview, which is the time that that departing employee is willing to open up about the good, the bad, and the ugly. But a lot of employers still quite worried about retention of employees and not losing people to a competitor have really grabbed on to this notion that if you sit down one-on-one with current employees, maybe annually, maybe every other year, and conduct an interview about their wants, their needs, their motivations, their interests, you will, in essence, cement their loyalty and perhaps get some great insights on the company itself you were not aware of. So that's the trend we're seeing. We're not sure if the results are proven, but companies are really jumping on the bandwagon.
Is that different than a performance review?
Yeah, it's a really important distinction and a great question. A performance review is a situation where the information flows from the manager to the employee. The stay interview reverses that flow so that even though the manager is still starting the conversation, posing topics, they're really asking questions. And then the employee is the one who's conveying the information that we hope is meaningful. But that's why, in essence, John, stay interviews can be the most dangerous of any kind of interview, because if not properly managed, it can turn into a real free-for-all and one the manager is ill-equipped to respond to.
What's an example of that?
So we've been helping companies, in fact, training them on the way to keep these stay interviews safe and not going sour. And one very common situation we have is a manager that doesn't come with carefully composed questions. They start so open-ended, so broadly, that the employee can go anywhere they want. So we had a manager at a local cargo company, and his tip-all question was, I want to hear anything at all that's on your mind. If it's bothering you, I want to know about it. He didn't even limit the question to the workplace. The result was employees started talking about their health conditions, their own heated divorce squabbles, workplace crushes, and then the HR team had to roll those conversations back, tell the employees this is not proper workplace discussion between a manager and employee, and it was a real issue in terms of morale. Another quick example, John, is companies where the managers have good questions, but they're not ready for difficult answers from the employee. So an employee might talk about what's happening at the food company and say, you know, by the way, those customers, they're a little touchy-feely. They're a little close for comfort on a personal space. And that comment comes up in the middle of the stay interview, and the manager, who's just got his or her list of questions, says, well, thanks for sharing. Now let's get on to your thought on the bagel recipe at the food company, not realizing, wait a second, this is a critical detour moment where I've got to let that employee know we're going to follow up on that issue. So it's both how you pose the questions and how you respond to what comes up in the context of the answers.
Is this a chance for the employee to say, I don't like the manager over in accounting, or I do or don't like such and such, or somebody's not doing their job? Is it an opportunity for that kind of conversation? Is that fruitful?
Yeah. Well, up to a point, yes. To your question and to your point, John, you don't want this to start as a gripe session or include interpersonal issues that really don't affect performance. You absolutely want to make sure that the employee knows, look, if this is about helping you achieve your goals, making sure your job is meaningful, it's about helping us do a better job of giving you the tools you need. So you want to keep a focus on what you are offering, providing the employee. But certainly, employees may bring up examples of situations which cue in the interviewer to some problem in management generally. So while we want to keep it positive, we do want to be open to those suggestions that are achievable and that are reasonable. And one really key rule is manage expectations. At the start, let the employee know we are not promising changes.
Right.
No decisions will be made here today, but we would love your input, your impressions, and your aspirations.
I just hate it if somebody said something bad about me.
Well, you know, I've only had good experiences with you on the radio, but you actually raise a good point by implication, because a lot of leaders don't know their own soft spots, vulnerabilities. And a good stay interview, while not turning into accusations, can reveal areas of inconsistency in management that no one knew about. So they can be a real positive as long as they're precisely managed. And those boundaries are important in terms of setting up the interview for success.
Philip Weiss talking about the stay interview. And by the way, one last thing, Philip. If I do it for some employees, do I need to do it for all? Like, the idea is let's keep our good employees happy. What about the lousy employees? Maybe you don't care if they stay. Do you do it for, if you do it for one, you do it for them all?
You do it for all, and you do it the same way for all, because that is such a pillar of good management and avoiding lawsuits. Do it. You just said it. We tell our clients, do it for one, do it for all, and don't act like your best friend in the employee ranks is a person you're going to be responding to more positively. Even nodding your head a lot when an employee makes a suggestion, that may lead them to think you're going to triple that employee discount mm-hmm. as they requested.
Yeah.
So be careful even how you respond to your favorite employee.
Seyfarth at Work is spelled SeyFarth. Seyfarth at Work. Philip Weiss is the president there. Nice to talk to you, Philip. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let's review the real estate scene. Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter at Cranes, is in our studios again to talk about the residential scene. How you doing, Dennis?
Great, John. How are you?
I'm all right. What's hot in real estate?
Well, to be honest, suburban markets are far hotter than the city these days. We're seeing some trouble in the city market, but in the suburbs, I did a story recently about homes getting dozens, literally dozens of offers. I think this one was a record, got 64 offers in Lincolnwood, 64 offers. So, you know, if you're in that pack of, say, back in the 50s and 60s, in that pack, you must be thinking, there's no way I'm getting this house.
64.
I found several others getting two dozen or more. It's remarkable.
If you get that many offers, doesn't that mean you priced it too low?
That's what a lot of people think. One of the problems is a lot of those offers are within the same price range. So, you know, you're asking, let's just say, $100,000. If you get 64 offers that are all about $101,000, that is a sign that inventory is so tight, people are really having to fight. If you were getting offers at $140,000 on that $100,000 offering, that would be a strong sign that you underpriced it.
Yeah. What's the sweet spot right now in the suburbs or the outlying areas, the areas you're talking about? Price range, is it 380, 420?
Really, from 5 up, 5 to say 7 or 800,000 is stronger, because those are the people who are less likely to be really sensitive to interest rates. Interest rates, of course, you know, went way up in 2022. They're down a little, but they're still far higher than they were for more than a decade. So if I'm looking at a $400,000 house, a $300,000 house, I'm really, in this market, really having to maximize what I can get for my dollar. Interest rates are turning some people off, saying I can't get enough. But up in the $500,000 and up, people are a little more comfortable, not quite as dependent, possibly paying cash, or if they're getting a mortgage, less dependent on the micro movements of interest rates.
Boy, it must be a lot of disappointed or frustrated people out there.
I think there are. You know, I talked to one real estate agent who said, yeah, we got 23 offers, and that means 22 people went home disappointed. Because it's not that these houses, like this one house that got 64 offers, is some super amazing, one-of-a-kind. In fact, the headline was that ordinary houses are getting extraordinary numbers of offers. The reason here is there's so little on the market, and there is interest in buying. So, yeah, I think there are people who go home and say, shoot, I've now made offers on 8, 9, 10 houses, and each time I've lost, do I reconfigure my finances so I can come in at an even higher level? Do I get off the market? What do I do? I'm sure people get very frustrated.
Here's how that story begins. A perfectly ordinary house in Lincolnwood, a brick three-bedroom, with the typical 90s snout garage parked in front, landed an extraordinary number of offers when it hit the market in April. In 2 days, 150 potential buyers toured the house, and 64 of them wrote up offers. A snout garage is what?
Well, if you're looking at the front of the house and most of what you see is a big two-car garage jacked out in the front, if you look at it, it really looks like a snout.
What a lovely description of somebody's home.
Well,
I guess if they had 150 folks walk through it, though, they don't care what you call it.
Other people don't mind the schnoz on the house. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no kidding. But again, priced attractively, or at least in that attractive zone of
at least, yeah,
prices.
And the agent knows, generally the agents have an idea, we're likely to go over the asking price, but they nobody anticipates 64 offers, and certainly, you know, and a price that goes up 30%, or an offer that comes in 30% over the asking price.
Now, this is in the suburbs. You say that in the city, the market isn't as strong?
We're not seeing nearly as much of that. There are homes getting multiple offers, but a story that I have coming out that I've just finished up is we've got 6 months straight of declining home prices in the city. We have, in out of 8 months, seven have declined, one was flat. And that's the longest we've seen monthly price declines since 2012.
And why is that?
The people I spoke to for the story, well, there are a lot of things. Work from home has really hit a city, because even if I was living in Beverly or Saugeenash, the far edges of the city, it was likely that that was because of the short commute downtown. And now I don't either don't have to commute at all or don't have to commute as often. So living farther out is an alternative for me. But also, almost everybody I spoke to said that crime is probably having an impact. That, you know, I look around and think, well, the McDonald's CEO said he was worried. Others have said they're worried. Will I invest the biggest investment I make in my life, if I'm middle class, should I invest it in the city or elsewhere? Which is not to say that the city market has gone, you know, completely kaput, just that prices have been sagging, and I was looking for an answer. They aren't sagging in the suburbs. And almost everybody volunteered. I didn't bring it up. Almost everybody volunteered. Crime is a big one.
That makes sense. I believe that. But I thought the condo sales during the pandemic were good in the city of Chicago.
So here's the thing, John. Those marquee sales, the $20 million, the $12 million sales, those are going really well. $1 million and below condos, really, during the pandemic, they didn't do so well because I wanted to get a yard. I didn't want to just be trapped. I needed a balcony if I didn't have a balcony, I really needed a yard. So, that part of the market really sort of sagged, and it continues to be weaker. We're still seeing the giant, one of the things I should say about city sales, even though prices are down, generally, the top five home prices of the year so far are all in the city. So home prices overall are down, but that does not mean people are forsaking the city. We're seeing people buy $10 and $12 million mansions and condos. Five highest prices are here, not in Winnetka, not in Lake Forest.
Where are they downtown? Are they right around here? Are they Gold Coast?
There are a couple of Gold Coast and Lincoln Park.
Yeah. Lincoln Park, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we've got sort of a mixed bag. You know, the person buying the $1 million home is very different from the one we were just describing buying the $300,000 home, and is also very different from the person buying the $12 million condo.
Well, the $12 million guy probably has another place anyway.
Or multiple other places, yeah.
Yeah. Brenda and I sold our condo during the pandemic. We had a dreamy, huge deck, but we wanted a yard. And they closed the lakefront, for crying out loud. And we lived close enough to it that it was very attractive. So we thought, you know what, we got to get out. And we found a house out in the exurbs, but we still kept a condo in the city, a smaller one. But we sold our, you know, main, our house was this condo in Chicago. And we were so happy to get a buyer, to be honest with you. It was a great, I think everybody came out fine in that transaction, but I can relate to the people who were thinking, I'm going to try and find some grass.
Yeah.
It wasn't about the crime. It was just about itching to get out, you know what I mean?
The parks were closed, my kids couldn't play soccer, all those kinds of things. So we did see a lot of shifting out to the suburbs. But quite a bit of what we saw was people, especially high-end people, buying out there, keeping the one in here. And what seems to have developed is, you know, I bought a huge place in Lake Forest. I also have a nice place in Lincoln Park, the Gold Coast. I'm dividing my time more than I would have been the way you might divide your time between the Gold Coast and Southwest Michigan.
You also wrote about the racial gap of the value of properties or the opportunities in the city, and about some well-known names and the sales of their places. We'll pick it up here in just a minute. We're talking to Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter at Crain's. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Illinois is among nine other states suing cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase. The lawsuit accuses Coinbase of illegally selling unregistered investments to more than 140,000 Illinois clients. Illinois Secretary of State Alexi Giannulia says the failure by Coinbase to register digital assets on a blockchain called staking offerings opened up clients to unneeded risk. The suit claims those clients were also unable to fully value the worth of their investment. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filed a similar lawsuit. Another favorite character is returning to McDonald's commercials. Ad Age reports Grimace will be the spotlight of a new ad that'll put the spotlight on the Grimace birthday meal. The McDonald's character is turning 52, and the birthday meal will include a berry-flavored purple milkshake. It'll also include a choice of Big Mac or 10-piece McNuggets with fries. It's the latest nostalgia-inspired ad for McDonald's and comes just a couple of months after one featuring the Hamburglar. Hamburglar returned to promote meltier cheese and a better sear on burgers. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. There's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. Let's talk about our morning news anchor, shall we? Steve Grzanich, of course. If you follow him on Instagram, you may have seen that he walked 25,000 steps a couple of days ago on the Lakefront Trail. That's pretty impressive, especially for those of us who struggle to hit 10,000 a day. And by the way, who came up with that number? But here is another overachiever.
Oh, gosh, I want to say the high was 27,000.
More from him after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for sponsoring us today. You can walk over to your Silverado and experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Super Stepper, sign in, please.
Doug Fricke, Director of Trade Show Marketing, National Pork Producers Council.
And he'll be racking up some more big step numbers tomorrow through Friday as he oversees Porkapalooza, officially known as the World Pork Expo at the State Fairgrounds in Des Moines.
It's a world-class event from the standpoint of if it has something to do with raising pigs, you will find it at World Pork Expo.
And they've got all the latest in technology on display.
Working smarter and having more things at your fingertips is really the key to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure the hog farmers are going to be in much of a buying mood for new gizmos and gadgets. There's too much pork on the market. Producers are being squeezed and even driven out of business as they lose money at their worst rate in decades. One Western Iowa producer told the Wall Street Journal he's losing $30 to $40 a pig, and he's not been able to make a profit so far this year. So new equipment orders and the like are off the table. But attendees at the expo won't have to spend money on breakfasts and lunches.
Nobody's going hungry.
It's all free.
If you can't find food at World Pork Expo, you're just not following your nose.
If you want to go, more info at worldpork.org. $20 at the door. And if you're going, do not wear new shoes.
Yeah, don't wear your Sunday best.
Because
as you come into the show, you will see specific checkpoints with foot baths that we ask folks to walk through.
It's a disease prevention thing. African swine fever, which has devastated hog herds in most of the rest of the world, has yet to make it into the United States, and they want to keep it that way. More info at worldpork.org. From the farm to your belly, today is National Applesauce Cake Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Now, what is the thrust of Chicago's racial home value gap, and how do we compare to other cities in the country?
We have the second largest gap among the among major U.S. cities. Los Angeles has a higher gap, and in Los Angeles, there's a giant concentration of wealth. This is a study from a UIC professor, a sociologist, who goes into mortgage appraisal, home appraisal records, and she found that the gap between the median in majority white neighborhoods and the median in majority non-white, majority brown neighborhoods in the Chicago area, not city of Chicago, but Metro Chicago. It's about six times higher in white neighborhoods than in other neighborhoods. It's a big gap. It comes from a lot of legacy issues like redlining, but it also persists today. I mean, the two sort of diverged many years ago during the era of segregation, but they have continued diverging because of disinvestment and other things. But the one thing that's important to keep in mind is part of this is perpetuated by the appraisal process, because, and I've talked to the Appraisal Institute about this many times, they're aware generally a junior appraiser is tapped by somebody who says, hey, come on into the business. So I'm likely to self-select. I'm likely to pick somebody like me who may transmit the same sort of racial bias I have. So what the Appraisal Institute is doing, trying to get rid of racial bias that may help to perpetuate these figures, is they're creating whole new ladders for people to enter appraisal so that I don't come in, I'm not tapped by somebody who thinks like me. I may be brown or black. I may not have a senior who can bring me in, and I'm more likely to be fair-minded.
Do the appraisers know the ethnicity or race of the home's owners that they're appraising?
Well, you've seen there have been studies in the last few years where, you know, a black homeowner takes down all the pictures, puts up pictures of a white family, and the appraisal goes up.
I have seen those stories. That is remarkable, although that probably doesn't explain the kind of gap we have in Chicago.
No.
That's historic.
Right. Yeah, it really is historic. I mean, when you go back to redlining and all the other forms of segregation in housing, and Chicago really was a capital of all those techniques for keeping black people either from owning homes or from gaining the financial benefit of home ownership, Chicago really created a lot of those vehicles and promulgated them around the country. And we're still paying, black homeowners are still paying that price.
And you said we, and then you corrected yourself, but I think it's even broader than that. None of us benefits from that sort of disparity.
Yeah, that's true.
I think when you decide to run the Eisenhower right through a black neighborhood or just a neighborhood, that's going to sort of split it for a lot of bad reasons too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and when you create redlining and say, don't invest in these neighborhoods because black ownership runs down the value of homes, that becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. Don't invest here, so more people don't invest, so the neighborhood runs down. So they really are looking at sort of the latter-day effects of what happened in the 20th century, but it's important to keep in mind that some of that is 21st century effect, or is 21st century causes.
Nick Kokona sold his old town home?
Trying to sell his old town home his own way.
What do you mean by that?
Not using a conventional real estate agent. He says that the incentive for a real estate agent is to get it sold, not to get the most money for the seller. And he wants to get the most money, or anyone who does want to get the most money should operate his way, which is where you give an agent a flat fee to reach a certain price. And then at any price above that, the agent is incentivized by higher and higher commissions. This is something he's used to sell a few other houses. Nick Kokonis, I guess we should say, was one of the founders of Alinea, Next, Talk. I think he's talked in here about Talk, the restaurant reservation group. They have this really very cool house in Old Town that they paid about $3.6 million for more than 10 years ago. And that's really all he'll say about the price. You know how much I paid. Now you come to me and tell me what you think it's worth. You, an agent for a buyer, come to me and tell me what you think it's worth. If you hit my number, you get the flat fee. If you go over my number, and I'm not telling you what my number is, you get more commission.
And agents will buy into that? Is the real estate community interested in that scheme?
I don't know. He has been on podcasts. I talked to somebody out in a western state who sold his house this way, following sort of the instructions of Nick Kokonis. And as I say, he's sold houses before this way. This one has just been on the market about a month and has not yet sold. But he did say that he had real estate agents call him immediately and say, I'll do all the work for you. You shouldn't go to this trouble. I'll do all the work. And he said, I got the time to do the work. So, you know, it's an interesting theory, and he does tell me, or he did tell me, he'll let me know how it goes, and it will be interesting to see if he gets over this invisible magic number.
Let's follow up. Dennis Rodkin, residential real estate reporter. Read him at chicagobusiness.com at Cranes. Nice to see you.
Thanks, John.